Nice to see you copied the mustache as well, right?
I look like you.
Yeah. So, advice for getting into PSA, any advice at all?
I think it depends on...
If there's anyone watching or listening that knows of a club in Hampshire, you let us know, and we will then... Hampshire. Why am I saying it like you?
I don't know.
No, I shouldn't do that. Does your dog have to be from a working line?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think the answer is, obviously there's things that we want to see within the dog, temperament-wise, personality-wise. This is a protection sport, right? So I don't care if my dog's ugly as shit.
Yeah, yeah.
If he can work, it's great. I got some ugly dogs, but they're intense.
At what stage do you start adding in obedience/neutrality around decoys/bite equipment?
I think if you have more of a reactive dog, if you have a dog that has lower, you know, thresholds of drives, those dogs tend to be...
I want to get into protection with my dog, but I'm worried he'll develop aggression. Can I do protection sports and still keep him as a pet?
A lot of the misconception there is my dog will become more reactive and more... aggressive towards those animals.
Mm-hmm.
But in a lot of times, it actually sometimes...
In today's episode of Caffeine and Canines, we have my good, close, personal and best friend, Jeremy Seapluck, all the way from the United States. Jeremy is a senior decoy and PSA competitor, as well as a dog trainer's trainer. This is actually Jeremy's second episode of Caffeine and Canines, so we talk all about PSA, dog training, his dog training journey, my dog, the type of dogs we have in the UK, and it is one of my favorite episodes. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. We'll catch you on the podcast. So we have special guest Jeremy Seapluck, hope I got that right, over from the States again for our second podcast now.
Yeah.
This is your third time in the UK now?
Yes.
And you and your wife have an affinity with the country, I believe?
Yeah, we might move here.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I know you were joking about it last time, but you are thinking about it?
No, I don't know.
You've got a job here if you do want to move here. Oh, yeah. 100%.
Perfect.
100%. Nice to see you copied the mustache as well, right?
I look like you.
Yeah. So, how's your trip been so far?
It's been good. Yeah. Nice weather.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, every time you come July last time, it should have been peak summer, and it absolutely pissed down all weekend, didn't it? So we've got a slightly different format of podcast today, where we put a question out to our audience asking for specific, perhaps, questions on PSA, PSA training, sport dog training, etc., etc. So we're going to fly through them. You know exponentially more about the topic than I do, so I'm going to let you kind of answer these. And if I have anything to chime in, I'll do my best to do so. But yeah, we've got maybe 10, 11 questions. Is that okay?
Perfect.
Cool. All right. Without further ado, we will jump in. So question number one is, advice for getting into PSA, any advice at all? Sounds like a slightly desperate question, but any advice at all on getting into the sport of PSA?
So I think it depends on where you're located. Obviously, if there's a local club, that's always the easiest way to kind of get involved within the sport, is to visit the club, see how it's ran, kind of, you know, interject yourself into helping out in some way. Another option would be to go to a PSA trial. And kind of just getting a feel for what the culture or the environment is like, and kind of getting a little bit more experience and exposure into that. But sometimes those things aren't readily available. There's not a local club, there's not a trial. And so in a lot of those cases, the best way about things would be to either watch. YouTube's got, you know, years of different trials and different years of scenarios and things. There's a lot of good, like, paid content that you can look into. Jerry Bradshaw's got a, you know, a Patreon account. Ben Lipinski's got a Patreon account. So anybody that is, you know, within the sport that is offering those services is an easy way. But sometimes, honestly, you got to just get out there and mess around with your dog. Even with my own dogs, when I'm not having a readily available decoy, a lot of times I'm just piecing things together so my dog gets some experience on me. And then I take what I've taught them and try to transfer it over. Yep. So having a basis of, you know, knowing what's expected in PSA, which we can find, you know, within the rule book or through watching videos, and then kind of, you know, chipping away at that.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, sound solid advice. Okay, next one.
Clubs or trainers in Hampshire. Now, I don't think you'll know that. Quite far, I know. I'm not familiar with a club in Hampshire, but if there's anyone watching or listening that knows of a club in Hampshire, you let us know, and we will then... Hampshire. Why am I saying it like you?
I don't know.
No, I shouldn't do that. Yeah, if anyone lets us know if there is a club near Hampshire. I know people around here, because if there's not a wealth of clubs just yet, are traveling a fair, you know, fair amount of time, 2-3 hours. So perhaps it's just expected, while the sport, I guess, is in somewhat of a juvenile stage in the UK, to be expected to travel in a couple of hours. So we'll try and find out for you. Next question is, how do I get started? So we've kind of answered that. And does your dog have to be from a working line?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think the answer is no. Does it have to be? No. Obviously, there's things that we want to see within the dog, temperament-wise, personality-wise. This is a protection sport, right? So having the capacity or the ability to do protection work, that's obviously a must, right? There are a lot of great dogs out there that have stellar obedience, but not as strong in the protection work. And that is, again, only 1/3 of the available points, right? So obedience is great, and we need that to move on to protection. But protection and intensity in that area is where you're going to be more successful. So whether the dog's from show lines or working lines, really, again, that's more or less a broad spectrum. It's not really about the individual dog that we have in front of us, right? So having somebody evaluate the dog and say, you know, what am I looking at? What is my dog potentially capable of? I think that's a better read for whether or not it's a show line or a working line dog.
Gotcha. Have you ever seen a show line shepherd compete in PSA?
I have.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's very many or no?
Not many, right? And I think, again, that just goes with the stipulation is, as a working dog trainer, you're not really recommending a confirmation or a show line dog, right? You're tending to steer your clientele or your prospects to a working line because you get a better chance of a positive outcome.
And would you say the limitations of the perhaps show line dog is due to the capacity to, or lack of capacity to tolerate the stress and the pressure of the sport? Or is it just the lack of the particular drives that the dog needs to go into protection?
I mean, I think that's the same question, right? It's the same answer to both, because in a lot of cases, right, we're looking at what are we breeding the dogs for, right? Beauty pageant or intensity. Most show line, you know, breeders are not really caring about how much drive does the dog have. They're not looking at, you know, how environmentally neutral is the dog, how, you know, strong is the drive in prey or defense. That's not important to them because it doesn't win them titles or championships.
Gotcha.
And so for us, we kind of look at the opposite. Like, I don't care if my dog's ugly as shit.
Yeah, yeah.
If he can work, it's great. I got some ugly dogs, but they're intense.
They can bite.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Next one. At what stage do you start adding in obedience / neutrality around decoys / bite equipment?
Good question. I think it depends on the dog. And the reason I say that is because I have had dogs that are a little bit overdriven.
Yep.
A little bit too much, right?
Yep.
And so recognizing that it's going to be a problem with some of those dogs, yep, I interject the addition to that stuff a little bit sooner.
Okay.
I want to have time to iron out details and make sure that the dog has a pretty clear understanding of what I want. Maybe a little bit sooner than a dog that is, I've got to build up,
mm-hmm,
right? And so I think, again, for me personally, I would rather take a dog that has too much drive.
Yep.
I want a dog that I have to kind of like peg down a little bit.
Gotcha.
Than a dog that I have to like really build up and spend a whole lot of time. Now, again, with that, you get the caveat. The dogs that you have to build up,
yep,
tend to be much more decoy neutrality, right?
Gotcha.
Neutral. Whereas the dogs that we have to really peg down, those are the dogs that are, you know, typically leaking. They're a little impulsive.
Yep.
They have more of that conflict of focus versus what their expectation is to bite. And so again, that adding that in a little bit earlier for me, I don't put an age limit on it, right? But I tend to be on the side that I'm, you know, a little bit quicker to start adding engagement and obedience in my dogs than some other trainers.
Yep.
I haven't found that that has really affected my dog's outcome.
Yep.
Right. Because again, I think I tend to look for those dogs that are a little bit more impulsive anyways. So it's just a little bit easier of a time. Where the dogs that I'm looking at typically when they're in the presence of a decoy or they're in the presence of what they think is bite work will tend to still falter to that instead of defaulting to engagement or focus on me. Whereas I think if you have more of a reactive dog, if you have a dog that has lower, you know, thresholds of drives, those dogs tend to be uncomfortable in those situations. And so they default to engagement and obedience because they're worried or uncertain about what am I supposed to do here?
Gotcha.
But if you have a dog like Stark, right?
Yeah.
No issue adding in control around a decoy well before you need to, because that's a dog that is a little bit impulsive.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to reel that dog in under stress at some point.
Yeah.
So I think, again, if we use the conditioning mindset that we want to spend time conditioning the dog around that stimulus, I'd rather have more opportunity than wait 4 years and then say, okay, now you have to do control work around a decoy.
Yeah.
So
would any other trainer think conversely to that and just build and build and build and build, then try and cap?
Yes. But even I think those dogs that you have to build up, it's not as much of an issue, right? Because then at that point, the dogs that you have to build up really weren't wanting maybe to do that in the first place. Gotcha. And so it's not as much of a distraction as it would be with a dog that is a little bit too extreme that you have to kind of work down.
Gotcha.
Right. So I've got a similar dog that, not as intense as my adult and my male dog. And I've got to kind of look at things the opposite way because I can do healing around a decoy. I can do healing around all of those things. And it's not really a trigger for her.
Mm-hmm.
What I struggled with when I had her, you know, kind of foundation work wise was getting her excessively loaded and getting her into that intensity and protection work that, you know, I think we all look for in a dog.
Gotcha. So. Very good. Okay. Well answered again. I want to get into protection with my dog, but I'm worried he'll develop aggression. Can I do protection sports and still keep him as a pet?
That's, I think, a common question most people have. Yeah. And I think, again, that just depends. This is all dependent on the dog. But,
of course.
I mean, I think, again, the way we approach protection work can really put in perspective for the dog some different things, right? So being around dogs that have a little bit higher tendency to be reactive towards either people or other dogs, right? A lot of the misconception there is my dog will become more reactive and more aggressive towards those animals. But in a lot of times, it actually sometimes helps. And the reason I say that is because it helps the dog understand a time and a place, especially if we combine that with obedience training or management throughout the dog's life. Now, sometimes we look at that as you're essentially teaching the dog to bite, and we may be potentially creating a more effective biter. But I think that tends to happen when we do things that isn't clear to the dog, right? So a good example of that would be like, let's say I start stalking the dog in the middle of the night in the woods and come up and put the dog into aggression and make him bite me. Well, I could expect that the dog starts to view that as a potential possibility, and we may run into those issues, right? So picking protection, and what does protection mean to you? What does protection mean to the dog, right? I think those are important questions to ask. Dogs that have a tendency to be a little bit more like actually human aggressive, and they're not doing it out of maybe prey drive, but they're doing it out of defense and their self-preservation of themselves.
Yeah.
Those dogs tend to work better in IGP or Schutzen because it's a much clearer.
Gotcha.
I'm biting a sleeve. This is about the object and it's not about the fight with the man.
Gotcha.
Now, PSA, obviously you've got civil scenarios. You've got a bite suit. So the dog's actually in some context thinking they're biting us.
Yeah.
So with those dogs that may be more on the extreme aggression or, you know, human aggressive side, maybe not the best sport for them.
Gotcha.
Right. So I think, again, it just depends on what is the goal. When we say protection, I think that is a very broad spectrum. It could be from personal protection to sport to, you know, PSA. It could be anything. So what does protection mean to us? And what does the dog limit us to do? Because, again, nobody wants a dog that is out of control or is a liability, right?
Yep.
We want to have that control. But I would say most dogs competing in PSA, they have to have control. And so I'm not really worried about those dogs being a loose cannon is, a, you know, English term. But
yep.
I'm not worried about them doing something unprovoked.
Gotcha.
And I think the training behind that helps us manage and control and create a little bit more guidelines. And I think, again, it really does depend on how you train the dog to do it. You know, if you're strictly working the dog in prey drive, I mean, that's all a game.
Yep.
It's possible to do, right? The intensity comes through defense work. We don't have to tap into that, right? It's better if we do, but we don't have to tap into those areas of training. So I know a lot of dogs that are strictly prey-driven protection dogs that wouldn't bite in a real-life situation. And if they did, they would be looking for a suit or game of some sort. And then I have a lot of dogs that, you know, again, they take it very seriously. And what we're doing in their mind is pushing them into that aggression state. So definitely dog dependent.
Not for those dogs that got a lot of hate in their heart.
I don't know. You just got to be more careful, right? I think we're both thinking about a dog in particular, and you got to be careful about the situations that, how does the dog view what they're doing?
Yeah.
Because we spend all this time saying no, no, no. And then one day we say, okay, it's a possibility.
The analogy I often give is that you take a young lad in school, you know, he's got a natural disposition to be physical, to want to do sport. He's perhaps competitive. He's 13, 14 years old. The testosterone's coming through. Now, in school, during PE, he can play rugby and he can just let that all out within a confined set of rules.
Yeah.
But then when he sits down for maths class, he has to sit there and not express those innate desires that he may have. Mm-hmm. And just being clear cut in terms of, here's a window in which you are allowed to express these desires. And then now is a window which you are totally not allowed to, is a better picture for that boy in this analogy than saying you're never allowed to express those desires,
right?
Because of eventually that boy then will start a fight in maths class just to express his desire to be competitive, to maybe display a little bit of aggression that he might have otherwise been able to express during PE, during maybe boxing or a sport in which he can
It gives him an outlet. It definitely, you know, if done correctly. The problem is that I think a lot of times we mix lifestyles a little bit, right? We take this a little too far into the realm of personal protection work.
Gotcha.
Which is the point of personal protection, right? To essentially view people or actions as threatening and to respond by protection. The problem comes in is what does the dog perceive as a threat, and when is the dog making decisions? I've got some intense dogs that may or may not actually do anything if somebody busts in my door, right? Because there is control and there is limitations of sport work, right? So you also have a dog that bite anybody. Right. So it's kind of one of those things. You just got to be careful in those contexts of how is my dog viewing it? And is this going to affect me later on? If I leave my dog in my car and my buddy tries to get into the car.
Yep.
is my dog going to potentially view that as somebody breaking in? We spend all this time carjacking scenarios, right? And then we get upset when things actually happen the way that we train. So you just got to be, you know, take that two extra seconds to think about, is this going to work out well in my favor, or is the dog left to make their own decisions and potentially do something that I've trained him to do?
So
it just it comes back to owner management and, you know, being an advocate for our dog.
When would you say it's not an idea to unleash the beast?
I would say if
someone comes to you and they've got a dog that maybe has that potential in them, what makes you go, let's not?
I would say when we're showing signs of, like, I think there's a healthy level of defense and suspicion, right? So a dog that is, you know, showing levels of confidence of, like, I look at this would be like barrier aggression. A lot of those dogs in barrier aggression, they look strong, they're barking, you know, like their chest is up, ears are forward. But then we start looking at dogs, you know, maybe where they're on, you know, somebody's got a back tie and the dog is backing up.
Yeah.
It's showing signs of like, I want to get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
Is that defense? Yeah. Right. The dog is saying, please don't come any closer. Right. Yeah. I don't want any more of this. So if I have that in combination with also maybe a bite record outside of like evaluation, right? Like if I'm thinking of a few dogs that I've evaluated over the years that have bitten multiple people, even their owner. And then when you start to push them into like, okay, let's see if you want to play with a toy, and the dog is viewing everything, all of your actions as defense.
Yep.
There's no confidence in it. The leash is slacked. They're like, if that leash was gone, they'd be gone.
Gotcha.
Those are dogs that I'm just, you know, it's more what we want than what the dog wants.
Yeah.
Right? In which the dog is viewing everything as uncomfortable. Could we maybe get the dog to eventually become out and stronger with that? Yeah, I'm sure. But it's a long road and unpredictable. So you spend years building a dog that maybe never actually completes your goal that you have for it, whether a much better dog suited for that type of work.
Square peg, round hole.
Yeah. And it's going to happen, right? Yeah. I mean, like, I think we can do a lot with what we have. Maybe it's never going to be the best of the best, but I mean, I have seen a lot of dogs successful that weren't the strongest dogs, in my opinion, that just kept on chipping away and kept on training and, you know, eventually succeeded their goals.
Yeah.
But maybe weren't the best dogs ever. So don't stop. If you have a dog like that, you know, continue trying. It's not a reason to give up, but just maybe look at what our limitations may be.
Gotcha.
Cool.
Okay. A few more. Is there any breeds you don't recommend doing protection sports with?
Don't recommend. I don't know if I wouldn't recommend.
So perhaps not breeds. So perhaps the question is, let's spin the question. Not breeds that are not suitable, but are there any breeds you just would go, definitely not. Don't go down that route.
I think we all going to have favorite breeds, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just look at it, if we're talking strictly, are we talking strictly like PSA or like sport work?
Sport work.
Yeah. Obviously, in any type of sport work where grip is being judged, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot when you pick a short mouth dog.
Yep. It's like a bull breed.
Yeah. Like, okay.
Or a Corso.
Right. And the biggest reason is you've got, you're never going to get full points in how the dog is biting, which means that you're automatically at a disadvantage than everyone else.
Gotcha.
Because you decided or picked that breed to compete in that sport. Now, that may not be everyone's goals, right? But if that grip is an important piece of your pass or fail ratio, in which you also have compounding issues, maybe the dog isn't as fast because it's a massive mastiff, and it's trotting down the field, right? And it's slow because of the size or the muscular, you know, stature of the dog. we have maybe some compounding things that is taking away from the ability of passing because of my dog's physical limitations.
Gotcha.
Right? If I'm 5 foot tall and I want to play in the NBA, I'm going to have naturally a harder disadvantage, a bigger disadvantage than somebody who's, you know, 7 foot tall that can push me out of the way and dunk, right?
Yep.
So you have to have a really, really, really stellar dog to be able to still be competitive, in my opinion, in a sport that is highly competitive. And there's just not that many dogs, you know, that can really make up for their physical impairments with obedience or intensity in what they do and sheer drive.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, that limits Rottweilers.
Yeah.
Right? It relieves a majority of the Doberman community. And mainly that's just to mass and size and density. There's a lot of good ones out there, and there's a handful that are competing in PSA. But I mean, if you look at the biggest gene pool that we're pulling from or breed is going to be Malinois and then potentially Shepherds, right? And that's mainly just due to their physical attributes, right? There's a lot of pit bulls that are, you know, competing in PSA or, you know, bully breeds. Not that many Corsos anymore. There's still a handful. But it's just, again, you're essentially choosing to have a harder road ahead of you, right? There's a few. I've seen a Australian Shepherd. There's a Patterdale. Right. There are off breeds, and it's fantastic that they're capable.
An Aussie Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. But again, it's just you're limited. You're limited at what you can do.
Of course.
So, for me, like, and again, that's where it's just the individual goal. For my goals, and you know, maybe like for me wanting to win. Being the best that I possibly can be, that's important to me. And so when one point could be first or second place, it's a little bit of a risk that I'm not willing to take. I want the best shot. And that may be, you know, again, a my opinion, but, you know, I think, again, nobody is taking a off-breed, you know, a greyhound and saying, I'm going to go win, you know, a national championship with this dog. It's just, it's not going to happen.
No.
So, goals.
Very good. A couple more.
Yeah.
How old is too old to start PSA with my dog?
Well, I just retired a 8-year-old dog, so it's never too old to start.
Okay.
And I would say that in a lot of cases, the older the dog, the better idea of nerves environmentally and, you know, physically that we kind of have. I think there's always a learning curve there of like maybe some, we'll call it training, right? Just, but like life experience. But I mean, you look at like a police dog, right? They're not really starting training until 1.5 years. Right, they're picking green dogs, which I mean, they've got some drive building and some things that they've done, but like there's really no formal actual work done until the dog's 1.5 years old, brought over from, you know, Eastern Europe or wherever they're getting dogs from, and they've got the genetics there, right? So if we've got a good dog with, you know, good environmental neutrality, we've got a dog that maybe has good genes as far as wanting to play with a ball. Maybe a dog that's a little suspicious and at times at night and things that it's, you know, kind of out of place. Yep. We've got a good base to work with.
Yep.
I would say the biggest issues with an older dog or getting started with a dog that is, you know, 4 or 5 years old, your timeline as far as training is drastically reduced, right? Like, while it's becoming more common for younger dogs to achieve higher level titles, so there's a handful of dogs that are competing in the threes right now that are around 2 years old.
Yeah.
That's uncommon, right? And those are dogs that have an intense amount of drive, and maybe some experienced handlers that have the ability to kind of like cut their training down a little bit.
Gotcha.
But, you know, starting a dog at 5 years old, it just means that we may be limited with our back end of our working career.
So it's reasonable for a 3-4-year-old dog to start?
I don't see why not. I mean, okay. I think, again, like for me, while I haven't just started training my dogs, I've know a lot of people, and I have myself have picked up dogs at a year and a half old and started their career. I don't show my dogs until they're at least 3 years old. So I spend that 3 years like kind of prepping and building and getting the dog ready.
Gotcha.
Because again, maturity is a big part of this. And so a young dog in that we push along and we kind of forgo that whole like sexual and social maturity aspect is we may have a different dog at 2 years old than we did at 1 year old.
Yeah.
And I think we start to see that. So a 5 year old dog is going to have obviously life experience.
Yeah.
That's always going to be a contributing factor is what does the dog expect and what does the dog consider fair or unfair?
Yep.
You know, if we drastically change their lifestyle, they've been free this entire time, then we start having a structure and a regimen. It's always easier to let the dog relax than it is to take a relaxed dog and impose strict rules. But I mean, again, working with pet dogs, we know it's possible.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit of a longer road.
Cool.
So, you know, maybe my goals with a 5 year old dog isn't a PSA 3, but can I get into the sport? Can I give my dog a hobby? Can I give my dog an outlet? Can I see what they're capable of? Those are all very realistic possibilities. And I encourage anybody that has an older dog that has the potential for doing this. You don't know if unless you try. Maybe this is the gateway dog into you getting another dog at some point.
Yeah.
And seeing, hey, let's see how much my dog can do. They love it. They find it's fun, right? Mm-hmm. There's satisfaction. There's inherent genetic desire to do it.
Yep.
So why not? Right?
Yeah. Give it a whirl.
Yeah.
I feel like a few of the dogs at our club will be gateway dogs for people to go on. And
it's maybe smarter for us to ease ourselves into the working dog world than to go out and find, you know, it's AVD, AVN, AVD?
AVD.
AVD, you know, champion.
Yeah.
That's my first Malinois, right?
Yeah.
Might be a little much, but,
yeah, running through brick walls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why it won't stop biting me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then last question is the difference between raising a working / sport dog versus raising a pet dog. And I suppose it's worth mentioning here that your day job is actually a pet dog trainer for the most part, or a pet dog trainer.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a wealth of experience in the pet dog industry.
Yeah.
How would you differentiate, or what advice would you give for someone perhaps raising their first sport dog versus the last time they raised their perhaps field lab or
that's a good question. I think the biggest thing that I look at is how I raise them is relatively the same. Mainly because what is most pet people's first instinct with getting a dog is to socialize, right? And socialization, I think, to a lot of pet people is I want my dog to meet and greet and be a part of my life. And we forget about that aspect of, like, independence. We forget about the aspect of neutrality. We forget about the aspect of, like, finding self-worth in us, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's, in reality, there's really not that much I would be doing differently with, let's say, our corgi that is not a working dog, that is a family pet, versus my Malinois that is, right? And the biggest thing that we want to look at is, like, management. That's the most common theme, but, like, a working dog needs just as much management as a pet dog, right? The only difference there maybe is that I spend a lot more time managing my working dog in as far as a little bit stricter rules, right? Very much less like freedom within the house, especially as they're growing into like an adult.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, they're going to be in a little bit more of a crate and a working rotation versus a pet dog maybe in a crate, a working, like training wise, and, you know, either tether or climb or something managed within the house, so they're out more, or in a pen or something that I can just manage the dog a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
My working dogs tend to, you know, earn their trust within the house, and I feel a little bit more comfortable with them doing things, you know, roughly around 2 years old. But I'm also dealing with dogs that inherently are going to find this couch as a toy.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the corgis, not going to, right? So that timeline is a little bit shorter with my pets, mainly because I'm not worried about them destroying as much, right? I'm still giving them more than I would anybody else, as far as like mental stimulation and physical exercise and time training and all those things. So for me, the training direction is still the same. We have to build value in ourselves. We have to create neutrality around new people, environments, situations. I want my dog to be neutral, not drawn or excited when somebody approaches, not fearful or worried when somebody approaches. And then just managing the dog in its, you know, day in and day out, so it's not learning bad habits right off the bat. So really, it's similar. I don't think I would really be changing a whole lot. Because again, you're still thinking about potty training. You're still thinking about like, what is a young puppy really doing anyways? It's eating, sleeping, pooping, and spending a little bit of time running around and doing things.
Yeah.
Right?
I think the average pet owner makes that a little bit of time, a lot of the time though.
Yeah.
And that's one of the downfalls is they give that puppy far too much freedom. Yeah. It picks up a bunch of bad habits that they have to then put in an excessive effort to try and stop.
Yeah. And I think, again, that the notion that crates are bad, like, think of it as, like, we use cribs for babies.
Right? I had a client once, and she was totally against the idea of crates, and she had a daughter sat next to her who was, like, 13, 14. And I said, this girl here, did you use a cot when she was a baby? And she said, yes, but I don't see a point, you know, and couldn't build the association that, like, she could not bear putting her dog in a crate, but was totally fine with, you know, giving her child nap times during a cot and crib when she was a toddler.
Yeah.
And then people just can't seem to get that.
I you're speaking to the choir.
Yeah.
And it's universally across the world. I mean, it's to manage what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's, nothing good happens in those cases, right? So
this is a dog that's, you know, destroying everything, pissing, shitting everywhere and, you know, biting her constantly.
Yeah.
But didn't want to just, you know, give it a nap away from her.
Well, can't win them all, I guess, right? Can only offer solutions.
Yeah, whether they take them or not, it's up to them. But that's the difficulties of being a dog trainer, I guess.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that person will come back a week later and say, you're still biting me and still doing all these things. So you thought about that crate yet?
Yep. Nope. Nope. One of these days, I'll learn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hopefully not.
Yeah, usually once they bite, once they bite them, they're okay, I'm ready
once
for
training. Once there's blood, something'll happen, something'll change. There's one more. I'm looking for my first sport dog. Where is the best place to look?
Well,
you may not be too familiar for someone in the UK looking for their first sport dog, I mean, but you might be.
I can't be and give specifics because I don't know too many breeders out here. But again, I will say that, you know, every time I've visited, it's always impressive to me to see the quality of dogs that you guys have out here. And I think that is a testament to your breeding expectations as far as workability.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think, again, in the United States, and I think it's universally over here as well, but, you know, color or rarity is a popular factor into breeding dogs.
Yeah.
And so I think, again, we have outbred a lot of quality traits in the United States. And so it's a little bit harder, I think, in my opinion, to find good working dogs in the United States. It's not off the table, but it's not as easy as it once was. I mean, if we really look back at Malinois in the 90s and the 2000s, those dogs across the board had pretty similar personalities and temperaments and drives. Mm-hmm. And now I think with the integration of a Malinois can also be a service dog. The Malinois can also be a pet dog in home.
And it can be blue.
Right. We've kind of lost touch with the potential capacity of these dogs. And so everything is kind of just a little watered down. And it's gotten worse within the last, I'd say, about 10 years. But that's also with the turn of, like, I want a Malinois service dog. I want a Malinois to do something it's not bred to do.
Yeah.
And so I always look back at, dogs that I found from out here are always a lot more stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more of the Malinois that I think we kind of have grown up and kind of like been introduced to.
Yeah.
Where you have the intensity, you have the drive, and you have the strength behind the dog, and you're not at this kind of like toss up of, what am I compromising with getting a dog from, some breeder in the States, right?
Yeah.
So I think, again, if you're in contact with, people within the community here, there's a lot of great dogs. It's the reason why we stud out a bunch of dogs from the UK mm-hmm. and ship semen
mm-hmm.
or send females, to the States, is because there's a lot of good gene pool out here.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's, again, whether it's, the sports that you guys do out here, whether it's just the workability and just having really good working dogs and breeding them. So I think, again, the gene pool is so big here that it's really hard to lose in that situation.
You're in luck if you're in the UK looking for a sport dog then.
I think so.
Brilliant. So that's about us.
Yeah.
Jez, put there.
Thank you.
And, media duty's done. Let's go and train some dogs.
Sounds good.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Bye.